The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Unpost. MyBills.ie. Help save time with bill payment online for free. Unpost. Do more.
And now we're moving on to other matters, shall we say. And sitting across the table from me is Keith Duffy, who's starting another career, you could say, in England around now, won the Irish Philanthropy Award this year and has many strings to his bow. You're very welcome.
Good morning, Marion.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you at last.
That would put you off flying, wouldn't it?
Well, it would, you know, and obviously because I'm based in Ireland, most of my work is based in the UK. I've been on 7 flights in the last 6 days. So for someone like me that travels regularly, it is a worry. You know, it's one thing if a plane goes off course, but then when it goes off course and it can't be found, I mean, it's very distressing. And Asia, Southeast Asia especially, for years the band that I was in, we travelled extensively across all of Asia and different parts of Asia.
Because you were very big in that part
of the world. That was one of our biggest selling audiences, and we spent the majority of our career from 94 right up to 98 in the Middle East and in Southeast Asia. So, you know, I know it sounds so far from home. It's like one of those things that it always happens to somebody next door, but yeah. I mean, it could happen to any one of us that are travelling out that direction, you know, and it's bizarre that there is no Irish people on the flight.
And is that part of your will it be part of your tour now with Boyzone?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the album we brought out last year, the BZ20 album, recognising 20 years together.
Yeah.
The territories in which we were successful before have all started to pick up on that album now, Europe especially, but also down Australia, New Zealand and Thailand, Taiwan, Malaysia were our biggest markets, you know. So it would be very much on the cards for us to be hitting down that direction later on in the year, you know.
Right.
Not to say that this flight will deter us, but I mean, it is a worry, you know.
Right. Well, it's just such a puzzle and a mystery and so on and so forth. Let me start with the philanthropy bit, and then we'll go on to the acting and the music and so on. You got this award for what you have done for autism, and your people are well aware that your young daughter has autism, which you kind of diagnosed nearly yourself way back.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if that's fair to say, but basically we definitely knew there was something not quite right with my little girl. From the age of, I suppose, 12 months up to 16 months, 18 months, she wasn't responding like an ordinary child of that age would. And we were very concerned. But at the same time, as young parents, you're kind of very ahead in the sand to a certain degree because you don't want to believe that there's anything wrong. And I think the first thing we did then, we decided that, well, hang on a second, she might be deaf and that's why she might not be responding. So we had her, like most families in Ireland or in Dublin especially, that have a child that they think might have a hearing problem, you bring them down to Sister Lydia in Cabra. And Sister Lydia has been sitting down there for years and she's seen most of the children in Dublin that have hearing problems Sister Lydia has assisted with. And we met Sister Lydia and she did her sequence of tests with me, and at the end of that day she kind of looked at us and said, your daughter's hearing is fine, but I wouldn't stop here. And that's all the information at the time that she was prepared to give me. Now since then, I believe and understand that she wasn't qualified to basically give her opinion. Her opinion being that, look, I've seen this a lot recently and it looks like it's surrounding that word of autism or Asperger syndrome or so forth. And she, you know, like I said, there obviously would have been families there. I mean, you can misdiagnose very, very easily, and some people mightn't have been as grateful as we would have been had she have just said those words, because, like I say, if there is a misdiagnosis, well, then Sister Lydia could leave herself wide open then to all sorts
of
problems. So we went from there, and the word autism kind of came into the world, into our world, and we start researching that, and every question I asked, unfortunately, I got the answer I didn't want, and then I needed to go forward. And the one thing that everybody said at the time, that early diagnosis is essential for the future of the child, or to give the child an opportunity to reach their full potential in life. And then again, there was no services available to us. There was no diagnosis available to us. We were put on a waiting list through the state to get a diagnosis, and I believe at the time the waiting list was 2.5 years. Which completely goes against what everybody else told us, that early intervention is essential, and you can't avail of early intervention if you can't get a diagnosis. So those 2.5 years are essential to the future of the child. So we ended up finding a doctor that that would have been qualified to give us a diagnosis. He was extremely busy at the time and couldn't fit us into his diary. So eventually we managed to get a meeting with him at 6:30 in the morning at his own home residence. And he asked my wife and myself, I'd say probably in the midst of about 50 or 60 questions, to which we answered every one. We had our daughter Mia with us on the morning. He never looked at her once. He just, like I said, asked us a load of questions. When he finished asking a sequence of questions, he went to his filing cabinet, opened it up in various drawers, took out various different pieces of paper, handed them to us and sent us on our way saying, "Your daughter has autism." Which at the time was absolutely horrific for us, you know. I mean, my family, Lisa's family and my family all knew that something wasn't quite right and that we might be coming home with bad news. So when we got back to the house that morning, I remember the family all waiting for us in the house where we all kind of crashed and I suppose cried our eyes out for a couple of weeks until we figured out what it was that we needed to do, you know.
And that started you out on this campaign that you have been going through of fundraising and ensuring that services are available to more people. What were her marks in her last exam?
At the Christmas exams just gone, she had 3 A's and 6 B's. And that's in peer equal school. She's a national school now, a mainstream school, albeit in certain classrooms she has a special needs assistant, but in general she's on her own, and academically she's doing extremely well. We're very, very proud of her and we're very lucky, and Mia is very lucky because she did receive the appropriate intervention at the right time, you know, the per se perfect time to kind of catch this, and putting in place the appropriate intervention at the right time really, really makes a remarkable difference, a minor miracle difference in fact, you know.
Right. Okay, well, I mean, and through all of that, you had to get on with your life and earning a living and all of that. Now, people have a view, because you were in Boyzone, that you have kind of gold bars dripping out of your pockets all the time and that you're all loaded. Is this true?
Unfortunately, it's not true. No, I mean, I'm not going to say the career that I started off in was I was very, very blessed to be given that opportunity, as were the other lads in the band. And we are in a business that you are in the position to make a good living from.
Yeah.
But we weren't businessmen. We were never told how to deal with our money. We were never told how to invest wisely. We were never told any of this. I mean, you try your best to do the best that you possibly can with what you have, and that's what we did. And unfortunately, like most people in this country, whether you be a milkman or a farmer or a builder, we all invested in property when we had spare cash, and we were no different. And unfortunately, like that again, the market crashed, the property fell down, and we all lost a lot of money. I can't speak for the rest of the lads, but unfortunately, a lot of the investment that I made it didn't pay me the way I was hoping to. And in fact, you know, put it this way, Marion, I'm working for a living again, but that way.
I was listening to an interview during the week with Shane Filan, and he did the same thing. He invested an awful lot in property, as a lot of people did.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make you think, sugar, you know, I had it sorted?
Well, I didn't invest to the level that Shane Filan did. I didn't have that type of money to invest, and I certainly didn't borrow to the extent that he did. You know, and he was unfortunate, but there is a comfort zone, especially when you have a child with special needs and you don't know the unforeseen kind of expenditure that might be coming around the corner. You know, so to be comfortable financially in a position like that, what you know, was a nice feeling. But nevertheless, I was still working for a living back then. I had made nice money. But at the same time, I had, you know, I had a young family, we had a mortgage and I had bills to pay. So I had to continue to work to make sure to provide for my retirement, which hopefully is a long time off now. But there is a comfort zone when you have money coming in regularly. But right. Then when it stops coming in, and obviously the band finished in 2000 and I was only 25 years of age at that point, I knew there was no doubt that I was going to have to go back to work. And when I say I had to go back to work, I wanted to. I was very, very ambitious. I was more ambitious at the age of 25 than I was when I started off in Boyzone, because I didn't have great belief in myself. I was quite an insecure teenager. So the success that came with Boyzone built up an ambition inside me. It made me believe in myself to the point that I can, if I work hard enough, kind of turn my hand to different things.
Which you do.
Well, it can't be said that I haven't left any stones unturned. I have tried my hand at a lot of things in the entertainment business, and some have been better than others, you know.
Splash.
Yeah, Splash was a different one because obviously over the years when you're in the business and you have a familiar face, you do get approached by various different TV companies based in the UK or whatever. And, you know, the likes of the Celebrity Get Me Out of Here and the Dancing on Ice and all these various different reality shows that the word celebrity is used a lot. And people with familiar faces are used to kind of create the entertainment for the shows. And none of them ever appeal to me. You know, I don't understand these Big Brother situations. Now, saying that, I was one of the I did the very first Celebrity Big Brother over 12-13 years ago, but at that point I was doing it for comic relief. We were doing it for charity. We weren't being paid. Everything was going towards comic relief, and it was done by Channel 4 and BBC. They worked on a joint venture together for that particular one. Since then, the following year, I believe the celebrities were paid up to 250 grand to take part in that show. So my timing was wrong again there, unfortunately. I mean, as my father would say to me sometimes, if it wasn't for bad luck, Keith, you wouldn't have any. If it was raining soup, you'd have a fork. You know, but you know, I saw this show Splash, and I kind of thought I had time in my diary, and this was a show with a difference because you're going in not knowing how to dive off the side of a board. I mean, we all go on holidays and we dive in off rocks and you know, the side of a swimming pool or what have you, but to be jumping off 36 feet and going at 38 miles an hour through the water and landing in the water without killing yourself, I mean, there's a skill set obviously needed for that. And in the contract it read that I had to have 40 hours of training done before I took any of this on.
Right.
And as people that know me, know I'm very sporty. I'm very active, mostly because fundraising for the charity. And I've performed in marathons and runs and triathlons and Ironmen and various different excursions across. We went to Machu Picchu and we cycled from Geneva to Monte Carlo. We cycled all across Spain last year. So I do kind of train very hard to take on these things that I wouldn't ordinarily be able to do without such training. And I'm not an athlete, you know what I mean? I am an entertainer. So these were all things that, you know, there were more, like you say, strings to my bow. And I just kind of thought, working with an Olympic athlete, getting 40 hours training and learning a new skill while on TV and entertaining my young family, I thought this would, a perfect opportunity for me to, to keep the profile of Keith Duffy's face on the television.
You don't like the ideas of celebrities, you don't?
Well, do you know, I don't. If somebody has a certain skill set and they go out and they use that to the best of their ability and they become well known for it, whether it be singing or acting or performing or on the radio or whatever it might be, wherever you shine, that creates more people will know you than will know Joe Soap, let's say. And if you're going to use that to your advantage, well done. But in the UK at the moment, and I'm not criticising anybody for that matter, but this reality thing has become a bit of a craze, and they have these shows like, I don't know the names exactly, but I know there's one called Towie and Geordie Shore, which are not acting, they're not scripted type shows. They're just grabbing people off the street and making them famous. And you know, what I believe now is the fact that your anonymity is something that's free, and it's part of life. And, you know, and if you're to give that up, you need to be rewarded for it. And you need to be rewarded kindly and financially, so that you can maybe try and buy some of your privacy back, you know. And it's like some of these kids that really don't know what fame is, but they crave it. And they go into these shows like Big Brother, and they're 9 weeks on television in people's living rooms. And then they come out and they didn't win and they didn't make any money out of it. And all of a sudden, they're back doing their day job, whether that be working as an accountant in an office or working stocking shelves in a supermarket. Everybody's going to know who you are because you have a familiar face. And your life, as you know it, is over. It's gone. And you're up for criticism through the press then because you are a household name. But you don't have any of the funds to be able to buy back some of your privacy, as it were.
It's an interesting way to put it. You reckon also that there would be a prejudice by people who are making movies or putting on plays against celebrity?
Yeah, I mean, well, in the business that I'm in, I'm very ambitious. I was very, very fortunate when the band ended. I didn't know where to go. I kind of felt very much isolated in a desert, and I didn't know what way to walk. I've never been behind the door and been very honest, and my vocal ability wouldn't have been that of Ronan or Stephen, God rest them. When they both signed solo deals at the end of Boyzone, I didn't really know what to do. I had a very familiar face. I was very, very well known, but how do I use that to the best of my ability to try and provide for my family, to try and get some sort of a job that gives me that rush, that energy, that fantastic feeling that you get when you stand on stage in front of whether it be 10 or 12 or 15 or 20,000 people or even up to 100,000 people, which we played in Hyde Park, you get that electric kind of hair standing on the back of the neck feeling when you're performing in front of people like that. And if all the fantastic memories that I'd built up in my life were over now at the age of 25, I mean, that's going to be quite a boring life. So I need to figure out how I can, you know, carve myself out another career in the entertainment business, and what is it that I can do that, you know, that I'm good at. And I was very, very fortunate to have landed eventually a job in Coronation Street, a show in which, you know, you're sitting in your granny's house on a Wednesday or a Monday evening, and at 7:30 you're all told to shut up because Coronation Street's on, and you know all these characters so well. And in those days we only had two or three stations on TV. We didn't have Sky TV where you've got 4,000 kind of programmes to pick from. So it was a show that was more widely watched back then. And then to get an opportunity for somebody to actually believe that you have, you know, the talent or what it takes to be able to be an actual character in a show like that was unbelievable to me. And there's a long story that goes with that. But ultimately, I ended up having a character created for me. And it was great because a British show that was so predominantly watched in Ireland, to have an Irish character in the show worked very, very well for the show and indeed for me then. And I was on and off for 10 years.
How did it come about?
Well, that's the thing. How it came about was when I came out of the band, I was working with various different bands that unfortunately never made the success that Boyzone did, but I remained friends with the members of the bands. And one guy rang me up from a band called Benz that we toured in their Smash Hits Roadshow for years all around the UK. And myself and this guy, his nickname was Dark Boy, and he came from Hackney in London. And he rang me up and he said, look, a friend of mine is putting together a short movie. It's only going to be about 15 minutes long. He said he has a feature, but he hasn't got the funding for the feature, so he's trying to put together a kind of a shorter version of the movie to try and get the funding to make the feature.
Right.
And because of your familiar face, it might help him to get the movie out there and more widely watched, and then in turn get the finances to put the feature together. So would you like to be in this little movie? And I thought, wow, I'd love to, this sounds great. So he gave me the script, I read the script, and I was playing an East London gangster I was like a henchman in an East London gang, with very much my Dublin accent. And it was very exciting. We shot in the morgue of an unused hospital over in Greenwich, and that was
very cheerful.
Yeah, absolutely. That was our HQ. And basically there was a scene where we had this guy who was tied up, and this guy had a gift basically, and anytime he looked into the face of anybody, he'd see a clock, and the clock was counting backwards.
Hello?
And that clock that was counting backwards was as many days and minutes and seconds you had left on this earth before you died. And he got this gift from the Grim Reaper at his 8th birthday, and all his life he'd look at his mother or his sister or his girlfriend, and he'd know how long they had left. So he wanted to get rid of this gift.
What has this got to do with Coronation Street?
Well, basically, this was the movie I was in, and this was how the excitement built up. And this guy was, long story short, we all get shot. We shoot each other and we all get shot. And it was a really, really great movie. It was shown in the Soho Short Film Festival. It won some sort of award on the night in question. There was a lot of writers, actors, agents in the theatre on the night it was shown. And this lady came up to me and she said, I'm an agent of such and such a writer who's just been commissioned to make 8 short urban myth chillers, little 8-minute movies, and he'd love you to be in one. I said, wow, fantastic, I'd love to be in one. And it was very exciting at the time because it was being shot in Bordeaux. So not only had I got an acting gig, they were flying me to Bordeaux to shoot it. So it kind of felt like I had a new career even without doing anything. So I flew to Bordeaux, I did that movie, and I was doing what you do, the press and the media surrounding the promotion of the movie. And the press department in Coronation Street read the article, and I've always worn my heart on my sleeve and been very honest, and I said, yeah, I loved it, because I didn't need 20,000 people standing in front of me to get that exciting feeling. I needed a cameraman and a director, and the hair stood up on the back of my neck, and I just remember feeling so excited shooting this short movie. But I said, who's going to hire someone that never went to drama college? Who's going to hire someone with limited experience as an actor? I mean, it's probably not going to happen. But I said, that is the dream now. The dream now is to go back and educate myself and and try and carve out some sort of a career for myself as an actor. The producer of Coronation Street, a man of Irish heritage, really loved the fact, loved the idea of the possibility of bringing an Irish man into Coronation Street. So he got in touch with me. I didn't have an acting agent. He got in touch with me through a celebrity kind of booker in London who got in contact with me, says they want to meet you in Manchester. They've read some article, blah, blah, blah. I went up and met him. I spoke to him for about an hour and a half. We spoke about Ireland. We spoke about his heritage, where his family was from. He said, look, I didn't bring you here to give you a job. I didn't even bring you here to audition you. I just wanted to get a feel for you. He said, but now that I've met you, he said, we are actually casting for a part. And he said, if you want to read for the part, he said, I'd be more than willing to let you. So long story short, I was in the Rovers with Mike Baldwin and Fred Elliott, and there was about five characters, and I read for this part. 3 weeks later, I got a phone call telling me I didn't get it, that they needed a more experienced actor, and you have to hit the ground running. And unfortunately, they didn't really believe I'd be able for it. So I was devastated at the time, not because I didn't get the job in Coronation Street, but because my belief in destiny and fate had been robbed of me. And 2 weeks later, I rang June West, who was the casting director, and I said, look, I'm just ringing to say thank you so much for that opportunity. I said, for you guys to even consider me, you know, thinking about it now was amazing. And to meet those characters that I grew up watching on television, yeah, was quite surreal. So I just wanted to say thanks for the opportunity. And she goes, Keith, have you not spoken to your agent? I says, well, I don't have one. And they said, well, this booker in London. And I said, no. And she says, well, we've been in contact with her, and basically we've decided to take the screen test, what you did, to the annual writers meeting in London, where there's 17 writers that write the show of Coronation Street. And there possibly might be a role for you if they decide to do that. So I got a call then a week later saying there was a unanimous decision from the 17 writers that we should create a character for you. So they did. That was Kieran McCarthy. I went in on a 3 month contract, and I was there for 10 years. So there you go.
Fantastic. And what, you're opening in London, isn't it? With the new play.
Yes, I've signed up to do a play in a small theatre in London called Theatre 503. It's like a little fringe theatre in Battersea. It's got a fantastic reputation. Some fantastic actors have gone before me in this theatre. It's a short enough run. It's only a 3.5 week run. It's a Billy Roach play from the Wexford trilogy, mm-hmm, a handful of stars, and I'm very, very excited about it because I've been very blessed, excuse me, because of my experience in Coronation Street, for other casting directors to take me serious as an actor, because that's been a real obstacle for me. And about 7 or 8 years ago, I did a play here in Dublin with Pauline McGlynn and Deirdre O'Kane and Don Bradfield called Dandelions, written by Fiona Looney. And that play was hugely successful. We brought it down to Cork when we finished in Dublin. And then we had a rerun again back up in Dublin and I believe in Cork again. And that was my first and only theatre experience, which I loved. I went on then, I did various series of The Clinic, which was the medical drama here in Dublin. I went back over, did more work in Coronation Street. I did various other short movies and one thing and another. And then Big Maggie came along, a John B. Keane playing that, yeah, Gary Hines was directing with the Druid Galway based theatre company. And they auditioned me for the part of Teddy Heelan. And the cast were magnificent in Big Maggie. And that was really, I suppose, my first real play, because it was an old play. It was, you know, yeah, John B. Keane, yeah, being the fantastic, yeah, playwright that he was. And we brought that show all around Ireland, every theatre in Ireland, in Ireland. But we played theatres that were so small that people were literally sitting and they could reach out and touch you. And that was the scariest thing I've ever done in my life. I mean, I've played in Hyde Park in front of 100,000 people. I remember doing the dress rehearsal in the Town Hall Theatre in Galway, and they brought in 150 students for the dress rehearsal, just to find the laughs, to find the, you know, the sincerity of the play, to find out how people were, yeah, taking what kind of perception of this play. And I remember standing at the counter. It was a shop counter in the actual set, and my legs were shaking so much. I was so nervous. I was terrified. And then when you deliver your lines, you do your scene, and you walk off stage. And I never remember feeling more excited ever coming off stage. And I just thought, this is amazing. I need to get more experience doing this.
Right.
And in theatre, it's not a huge payday. It's not a huge payday. You have to do it for the love of the business, the love of the art. And,
right.
and I really do have that. I found that love. So you have to have other jobs that are bringing in other money in
then
to allow you to afford
to do
when
that.
You have got big bills and, you know, whatever, to be able to pay your bills and to enjoy yourself.
Now, but obviously Boyzone have regrouped and all of that. When you started out in Boyzone, I remember Ronan in particular used to get really annoyed that people didn't take you seriously and that you came in for an awful lot of slagging. And I mean, you said yourself you took some shouting and abuse and all of that. And I was just wondering, because last week Bono made this speech in Dublin at the Convention Centre. I'm not sure if you're aware of it. Lord save us, the criticism that he got was unbelievable.
Really, I haven't heard anything about it. I've been away. Like I said, this week alone, I've been on 6 or 7 flights. I'm in and out all the time at the moment. So I didn't hear the speech he made. But yes, when we started off, we were highly criticised, you know, and it was difficult because when you're 18, 19, you're insecure. You don't know where you're going. You don't know who you are. You're trying to be cool. You want to try and say and do the right things. You want people to like you. You need acceptance. And when you've got other guys the same age as yourself, and it can be put down to jealousy, it can be put down to whatever you want to call it. But at the time, it was very, very, very difficult. And it lasted, especially with me. I'm very sensitive. I've learned and grown to know that I'm quite a sensitive soul. And at the time, it didn't help with any insecurities that I might have had. Being criticised, slagged off. We didn't have the money to have chauffeur-driven cars pick us up from our house and bring us to wherever we needed to go. Myself and Shane Lynch grew up in Donaghmede in a place called Grangemore. And we'd have to walk from Grangemore down through Donaghmede at the Hope Junction train station to get the train into town. And you'd meet various people on that journey from Grangemore to Hope Junction. And the majority of them would be shouting abuse at us and calling us all sorts of names and one thing and another. And thankfully, it didn't take too long before the success of the band kicked in. And then there was other territories very interested in us. So we were travelling abroad quite a lot then. And, you know, it got to the point that, you know, I remember back in 1996, our tour operator told us that we actually had 146 flights within that year. And we had travelled to over 35 countries, you know, and, you know, you get back home to Grangemore where we grew up, and the lads that we hung out with were still on the same street corners, and we'd seen so much of the world. We were so blessed, so lucky to have experienced so many different cultures, and trying to explain that to the people that were hurling abuse across the road at us was impossible. But you had to just understand that was the mentality at the time, and we weren't U2, we weren't a rock band, we weren't somebody for the Irish people to stand back and be proud of. We really didn't have a big pop group or boy band come out of Ireland before Boyzone. So, you know, that kind of music and that style of performance was criticised, highly criticised, and we were the members of that band. So, I mean, you grow up and you understand where people are coming from. And literally only the other night I made this joke with a pal of mine. I flew in on today's Saturday. I think I've flown in and out most days this week, but on, I think it was Wednesday night, I flew in and I was picking my wife up from a restaurant in Malahide, and she wasn't quite ready for me. So I popped into Gibney's in Malahide for a pint. And I met quite a few people out the back of Gibney's, and they were all looking for a photograph taken with me. And albeit there was 2 or 3 ladies there, but there was about 7 or 8 lads who I actually made a joke with. They said, "Lads, do you know, 15 years ago, you lads would have been slagging the hell out of me and I would have had to leave this pub." I said, "Now you're here looking for a photograph taken with me. Thank God those things have changed, you know, thank God."
And they most certainly have. And congratulations to you. And I hope that the play is a great success. And
please,
thank
God.
You very much. Much indeed for coming in. And that was Keith Duffy, and we're going to take a break.
1850 715 150.